Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the third of four streams tonight, and this is with Clossington, who has his own YouTube channel, and he is part of what is called NRX. Clossington, welcome to Millennial, and can you explain to people, just a brief introduction, as brief as you can, what is NRX?
NRX is essentially an elitist school of postmodern reactionary thought. The point of NRX is essentially to update the old ideas of De Maistre, Mosca, Thomas Carlyle, and apply them to postmodern philosophy, specifically the philosophy of Deleuze, Guattari, and Baudrillard, and sprinkle in some Hoppean Austrian economics.
Okay, and which is libertarian.
That's a lot, but we
were saying before we went on air that there are two main thinkers in NRX, and actually, should we say what those abbreviation means?
NRX just means neo-reactionary. So instead of falling for the modernist reactionary pitfalls, you have to apply postmodern praxis to postmodern politics.
Okay. All right. And there are two main thinkers, Nick Land and Mencius Moldbug. And you said to me that you're far more in the Nick Land school than Mencius Moldbug.
Yes. Mencius Moldbug, his main shtick is pop history and pop economics. Pop history, specifically with regards to his mapping out of what he calls the cathedral, which is essentially...
We'll go into that in a minute.
We can get into that later, but Moldbug provides the history, and then Nick Land provides the postmodern philosophical context. Nick Land, of course, is... he used to be a professor of philosophy once upon a time before he was sort of unpersoned. I find Nick Land to be a much more succinct thinker, better put together. Moldbug tends to be... Moldbug's content is sort of ironic blogs that actually have a lot of, I guess, resonance with what we're actually going through. But Land actually lays down real theory.
Right, okay. I mean, Nick Land is an English philosopher. I didn't actually know that he'd been unpersoned. When I first got into all of this, which was a long time ago now, 6-7 years ago, he was still making it as a professor in a university, or I don't know if he was a professor, a lecturer in a university, as I recall. He still seemed to be part of mainstream society at that point, so I didn't know that he'd been unpersoned.
I mean, he hasn't been unpersoned per se, but he's living in China right now. I think he lost his philosophy job. I'm not sure what he's up to today, but I guess the current wave of NRX content is to dig up these old concepts and these old theories and see if there's any way we can make sense of the current political situation through that lens. And Land has a lot of older content from like think back all the way to the 90s. But a lot of the problems he lays out in Fang to Noumena have a lot of resonance with what we have, with the issues we have right now. So I guess that's the whole point.
He is less... I mean, I would say he's slightly less well-known than Mencius Moldbug, at least in our circles, in the online sphere. What was called the reactosphere then? I mean, it's funny to think of the history here, that it really, from my point of view, there was the reactosphere, NRX. I can't remember what the distinction was between those two things, honestly. Then the alt-right, then the dissident right. But NRX lost favor because it was so elitist and frankly quite stuffy, when the alt-right was far more populist but also far more energetic, and frankly more lowbrow for sure. But it also seemed to seize life in a way that than NRX didn't. NRX was very aloof and distant from that kind of thing. But the alt-right has come and gone, whereas NRX is still around.
I've had a lot of these sort of discussions about political praxis and actually make an impact on the real world. And guys like Charlemagne and I like agree, you actually have to break some skulls in the real world to make a difference. And the sort of conclusion we've come to is Moldbug talks about how there are certain ways to reset the cathedral. And we came to the conclusion that the cathedral ain't going to reset itself. So we were out in D.C., of course, knocking heads with Antifa and being on the ground. And we fully encourage everybody to go out and participate in IRL IRL political movements, as opposed to, I guess, the stuffier bloggers who are kind of fine being keyboard warriors.
So what would you say then is, well, if we go to the keyboard warriors, what would you say is their attitude to changing the world? I mean, because obviously there is, I mean, I'm looking at what is the alternative to doing popular demos, trying to public stuff, populism. And I'm not even against that. I'm just noting it as a thing. And appealing to the current system. What is the alternative to that?
We'll get on to, what sort of postmodern reactionary theory actually is. But the most concise way of putting it is that the only way to deal with certain inescapable loops is to reject what they call the outer parties, the Tory party in the UK or the Republican party in the US, reject sort of rural bumpkin conservatism in favor of more hierarchical urban elitism, because the one sort of common thread or common moral stance that the right takes or has taken throughout history is that it is fundamentally hierarchical and not egalitarian. Like everything else is sort of scraps from the broken shards of progress. You could say something like the Daily Wire in the U.S. is willing to talk to second wave feminists because they were ejected conservatism is more than happy to bring them on. You know, it's like NRX fundamentally rejects the framing of conservatism is liberal, what liberalism was 10 years ago, and says cut straight to the chase. Everything and everyone is different. And also try and, stall certain loops that capitalism is fundamentally barreling us towards.
Yeah, exactly. Conservatism tends to be comfortable with whatever liberalism was saying 10 years before. So it effectively acts as a reinforcer of liberalism. The actual liberals are free to blaze the trail, but the conservatives maintain what was established 10 years before. It's a ridiculous situation. Even on the face of it, just as an outsider, you would think that's a ridiculous situation. The conservatives are supposed to be opposing their opponents, when in fact they're reinforcing their opponents.
Yeah. Before we went on air, you asked me to give you, of course, a couple little talking points or quotes I want to bring up. Of course, NRX has the quotes, Moldbug's quote, Cthulhu swims slowly, but he always swims towards the left. And There's also Hans Hermann Hoppe's quote, civilization is synonymous with increasing time preference. With regards to time preference, the compound growth of capital demands that the compound growth of capital and the expansion of markets beyond what used to be the medieval market square always leads to the deterritorialization of products and the formation of new identities that are not authentic, which leads to Nick Land's conclusion that the left thrives on dialectics and the right perishes by them. That's a lot.
Start one thing at a time. Let's start at the beginning. What is Cthulhu? What does that mean?
Okay, so I guess this is... What is Cthulhu? The Cthulhu, in its most modern incarnation, is the cathedral, which has a long history that Moldbug has talked about.
We'll get to the cathedral later. I just wanted to explain this expression, this phrase. Cthulhu swims slowly, but always to the left. What is the point of that expression?
The point is that in Lovecraft's short story, Cthulhu is it's a Lovecraftian monster, and it's rising from the depths, and there is a little boat that tries to ram it, but there's nothing you can actually do. All you can really do is, try and get out of its way. That fits very much into, what Anarchs is all about.
A sense that decay is ever present.
Things fall apart.
Yes. So that's a sort of axiom of NRX.
Yeah, pretty much. So to sort of give an example of this, I could talk about deterritorialization, which is the process of Cthulhu swimming left. So you have a sacred symbol, right? Or you have a certain foundational value. Now, markets being what they are, they'll take your original symbol, process it into a commodity, and then that commodity becomes no longer sacred. So think about the American flag, right? It's a sacred symbol of America. And once upon a time, is illegal, or we tinkered with the idea of banning flag burning. But what does it mean to have underwear made with the image of the American flag, or brownies that you could consume with the American flag on it? It's not too sacred. Or think about, what does it mean for the American flag to be mass produced in China? Or what does it mean if, I saw this good meme on Twitter earlier today that showed, the first image was just a fish swimming around. The second is a grilled fish, which is a commodity. And then below that is fish sticks, which is, completely reprocessed and recontextualized, but it still has the original image. And at the bottom is Oreos that taste like Swedish fish. So at that point, fish does not really mean anything at all. And the it's wacky, but that is what Cthulhu Swing Left looks like. It's the disintegration of things of sacred objects like, take gender, or take the nation, or take nationality. Unless it can be commodified and recontextualized and therefore desanctified, it is useless. And things always fall apart, so everything will be deterritorialized.
Oh, hold on. Unless it can be disintegrated.
Unless it's defined, useless.
It is useless to whom?
I guess just markets, right? Who cares about some rare bug or plant in the middle of the Amazon? It has no use. unless it can be slapped onto a t-shirt. And yeah, it's like
this is a comment of what unbridled market capitalism
does
to life, to people's perception of the meaning of things.
Yes, that is correct. That's the NRX analysis. And that kind of gets into, I guess, the hyperreal condition, hyperreality. So what happens is, have you ever been to Disney World or Disneyland?
Actually, I have.
Have you ever gone to Epcot Center?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A long time ago,
like,
but yeah.
What does it mean for Epcot Center and these like little countries, these little locations, to be more real than the actual locations? You know, you could go to, I bet the English exhibit in Epcot Center is more fun than actual real England. It's a gross exaggeration, but it's the analogy.
I mean, I honestly can't remember. It was 1996, a long time ago.
Here's another example. Jean Baudrillard talks about how war is realer on. Well, he was a journalist for the Iraq War, but he talked about how war was realer on TV than it was in the actual field, because this was a video game war, where I guess. The images shown on TV are more, I guess, put together and packaged than the actual images on the ground. So what does it mean for war to be a video game and for video games to feel more like war? I guess that's the drone pilot's conundrum.
I'm wondering in what is that ever actually true, though? I mean, if war feels less real to you than a video game, that's probably because you didn't know what real war is actually like, surely.
Yeah, but the thing is, we're coming on to an era of a fourth generation of warfare that is largely asymmetrical, and it's not exactly put together. But that was just a sort of an analogy that I came up with on the side. Those are sort of that's sort of the postmodern background to NRX, right?
Yeah, I don't want to dismiss the concept that an imitation of something can be more true to that thing than the thing itself is after sufficient degradation, after sufficient decline.
Yeah. I mean, what does it mean to be a man when life is fundamentally cucked at the moment, right?
Well, yes, that's a question that we're all trying to answer.
There's also the sort of idea that, I guess, with deterritorialization and hyperreality, like Nick Land has this good quote, it's the arc of history is long, but bends towards the zombie apocalypse. The idea is that once everything is rationalized or condensed into technique, like Keith Woods, he introduced Jacques Ellul and his concept of technique. But once everything is rationalized, sort of more human, empathetic bonds that fundamentally and metaphysically bind everything together, those will fall apart. For instance, like has crime one of the biggest oopsies of the 20th century is how crime skyrocketed, like starting in the 60s and then abruptly ending in the 90s after, well, I can talk about it later, but society falls apart, the market expands, and now we are left with nothing but markets to cater us goods, rather than having, I guess, the market segregated to a specific space. You know, you go to the church for religious fulfillment. You go to, like, the home is for child rearing. The farm or the factory is for work. But what is Twitter? It is news plus entertainment plus religion. Everything is everything is combined into a mush, and then that mush leaves you kind of schizophrenic and huddled in your little pod, drinking pureed bugs, and you have mental illness, and it's rough.
Yeah, so I mean, capitalism has reached a point at which it's able to dominate all of life, all aspects of life. Everything has become a commodity, a consumer experience, a consumer product, and in the process of that, real life has become dominated by replicas of it.
Yeah, simulacra and simulation. This has a lot to do with, I guess, like Max Weber had a good word for this, or a good term for this. It's the demystification of the world, right? The world is less magic than it once used to be. And I guess that's what happens when all of the unknowns are found, and when all the dark corners of the map are actually known. There's nothing real to be explored. I'm a huge fan of Bronze Age Pervert, but he talks about Bronze Age Pervert talks about in his book about how man is fundamentally cucked, how our ancestors, you know, they burned down buildings, but now we sit at wine bar with girlfriend and talk small talk. The world is a whole lot less human.
Well, it is. I mean, this is what Fight Club was talking about, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that there's so much comfort and luxury now, and everything is so pre-prepared for us, that it's very difficult for people to have what you might call authentic experiences at this point, because you can always just plug into some consumer version of that. That is true, and also there's not much real struggle. But again, I think that this might be a view of life that is that has a certain longevity, a certain limit, because it relies on prosperity, doesn't it? I mean, sure, it relies on things continuing as they are.
Yeah, Moldbug has a couple good blogs about postmodern capital, as he sees it, as an amateur economist. You know, he talks about how what is the U.S. economy fundamentally? Like, we don't actually make anything. We more or less just slosh around hedge funds that are built on perpetual population growth and the growth of the real estate industry. And now I guess we're pegging it towards technological growth. I guess one of the other elements of early NRX was transhumanism and discussions about the singularity, but I'm not as well read on that, and that sort of has fallen out of favor.
Well, there is the I don't know. I'm interested in this idea that at the start of the lockdown in March, there was a sense that, oh my God, this is what it's going to feel like when the system starts to fall apart. And that was not the system falling apart, but it gave a sense of what that experience will be like, because suddenly things that worked and that were available were not available and didn't work.
What does the future look like if every 5 years you have a coronavirus and the system, which is predicated on international trade and the flow of international goods, has been shut down?
Yes, but also just whatever happens, if at some point the system does fall apart, the things that NRX seems to take for granted will go away. I mean, the transmogrification of life into a series of consumer choices and just consumer experiences, that's going to go away, surely. And we'll be left with, oh shit, I actually have to find firewood. Things, you know, experiences like that. Of course, this assumes that this would require the system actually falling apart. I'm wondering, does NRX have something to say about that? Or is the assumption that the system is so robust now that it just won't fall apart? It will just continue adapting to new circumstances.
I mean, I'll have to default to something like a more cyclical view of history, sort of the Spenglerian cycles. That's just my sort of view of what history looks like. Within the NRX postmodern worldview, you see, I guess, culture, like Spengler's culture being created during the early to late medieval ages, right? And then we're sort of living off of the deterritorialized fumes of a civilization that was won through hardship. What does it mean to run out of fumes? And the answer is a zombie apocalypse. There are two sort of options that you have, right? There's neo-Ludditism, you know, embrace Ted Kaczynski. I'm not sure how many people are up for that, or at least willing to go down that route. And the second is
not many, demonstrably.
We don't like exactly Fed Post, but Luddite and smashing the machines. That is effectively, removing yourself from power. You know, Moebug talks about how, I guess, the most successful groups at combating modernity are the Amish. Of course, you know, they've maintained their sort of, I guess, pre-modern lifestyle with the cover of being a pacifistic agent in markets. And that's one route. The other route is rid the cathedral of its most cancerous elements before the zombie apocalypse or before ecological disaster happens.
So in this worldview, what would cause the zombie apocalypse?
Land talks about how it would look something like I think I tweeted about what Land views the zombie apocalypse to look like, but it's imagine the growth of cities to the extent that they look like some Kenyan slum, but it's managed by a Chinese Mandarin caste of bureaucrats, a society that has devolved to this incredibly low level, and yet, I guess, in your sort of Silicon Valley, I guess, tower blocks, you know, you have the most wondrous technology out there, but society has fallen apart. That's the view of Elysium or Detroit, or imagine what would happen if every city looked like Detroit. It's not fun.
Yes,
and I think to kind of draw in like a leftist philosopher, like Derek Jensen talks about how civilization is synonymous with the growth of cities, but in sort of the Spandrel, like I've done a video on Spandrel's IQ shredders. I'm going to come out with a sequel to that. They'll release on Christmas Day, but the growth, it's more, we're dealing with the growth of the city mindset, which is not good because cities are inherently unsustainable and rely on hinterlands for their biocapital. I guess another theme of NRX is it's incredibly autistic. So you're talking about biocapital and trends in a very autistic manner.
Well, what is biocapital? What does that mean?
It's human capital. It's treating humans as if they're NPCs in The Sims. That's what biocapital is.
That's a bit grim.
Yeah, well, that's public policy. And we've got schools dedicated to that.
Well, I was talking with my previous guest. I was talking about how they just brought some, I've forgotten who it was now, some corporation just import a bunch of workers from, I think, Bulgaria to Ireland to do some work. I've talked about it in my own videos where we now have this world in which it's really nothing for, human labor to be deployed in across the world. It doesn't really matter where it is, where it's located. It can be moved to a place where it is needed, or it can work remotely. So it's just human stuff, really, whether it's meat for like muscles to do physical labor, or it's brain to compute things.
Like, what does it mean for Ireland or for Scotland's economy to be if, like, what does it mean for their economy to be based on call centers where laborers are kind of interchangeable? All you really need to know is this lowest common denominator skill, right? And the nation is, it survives or dies based off of market forces. So it better import those Bulgarians or the wage might be above market demand, and then you won't have any call centers, and you'll just
kind of... Well, this is the whole problem with globalization, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of my previous guests made this point, that the end result of a global market will be a global value to labor. Go on.
There is a solution that Moldbug lays out in... it's this essay, Sam Altman is not a blithering idiot. Moldbug has all these sorts of sarcastic titles. But in order to combat the increased reliance on technology and the deterritorializing effects of capital and the fact that technology is outstripping its need for human labor, the only way of combating this and maintaining a national economy is something like autarky in the form of targeted, targeted neo-Ludditism. So your farms, you can't use modern farming techniques, and you must use, convert to craft labor. No more industrial farming. So it's a make-work scheme through targeted technological retardation.
Yes, you have to artificially prevent people from using certain technology, which is too useful.
Like, towards the end of his essay, he uses the analogy of, I see Morgoth was in the chat, the YouTube chat earlier. Morgoth, I remember he quoted something about we're drowning in fried chicken and plastic crap, right? Moldbug says, what do you do about this plastic crap? Well, you could ban Chinese plastic toys, set up some, wooden toy manufacturing jobs in the UK or US. That's one thing you could do. It'll make toys a little bit more expensive, but in the end, do you really want to drown in plastic crap?
I mean, that's what I would do if I were in charge. I would, I would target, I would ban things. I'd go for protectionism and so on in order to revive national industries, local regional industries. Absolutely, I would do that. I don't really know why it's a dilemma, unless you're just a complete slave of global capital. But
that's the problem that we are.
Yeah, well, our politicians are. I'll return to one of the phrases you used before. The left thrives on dialectics, the right perishes by them. Could you explain, for anyone who doesn't know, briefly what is meant by dialectics, and then explain that phrase?
Okay, so this phrase came from Nick Land's essay, The Dark Enlightenment. Dialectics, it was a term developed by Hegel to I guess, give a... It's a Hegelian view of history and conflict resolution, as well as sort of a way of discussing how humans identify with themselves. But we'll just stick with the phenomenological way, the phenomenological definition. Dialectics is when you have a thesis, and that thesis is your initial presupposition. That comes into conflict with its opposite, the antithesis, and there is a conflict here, and out of that conflict is a synthesis. So, so hypothesis, you have a pre-existing culture, idea, product, whatever you want, a competitor, or some sort of material change happens, and then you have to react to this change. And out of this reaction, something new will be created. And in its wake will be the shattered remnants of what used to be. So so that's what I was discussing earlier with the right is just whatever sort of scraps the left has or progress has left in its wake. So we will we're not going to get back to like, sorry, Tradcasts, but we're not going to go back to absolute monarchies anytime soon. That's been completely crashed and destroyed to hell. You need to come up with some new ideas.
So can you explain the phrase now, just to make it clear?
So the left thrives on dialectics, the right perishes by them. So leftists, they fundamentally... they live and die by ideas, like these abstract ideas. You'll be unpersoned if you have the wrong ideas that are not in vogue. Leftist infighting is notoriously petty and hilarious to look on at from the outside. But the love of dialectics and the fact that dialectics results in an even stronger, more anti-fragile left means that they will always come out the other end stronger. So when they purge TERFs, and let Ben Shapiro interview the TERFs, they just show that who is actually coming up with new ideas and who is an actually organic movement and who is just a grifter.
So why can't the right do that? I mean, why does the right have to perish by dialectics? Why can't the right?
Because it is, I guess it's stuck trying to, like, I guess temperamentally it doesn't want change or wants to maintain some status quo, whether it's the status quo of 50 years ago, 100 years ago, or 200 years ago. And when righties start suggesting new ideas, they fundamentally become less right, definitionally.
I don't know. I understand what you're saying. I just think surely it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, surely, unless the right is just a sort of retardation, just an allergy to new ideas. I mean, if that's what it is, then why the hell would anyone be right wing?
Well, I think there was a good quote from Nick Land that I tweeted out like a couple months ago. It was something like the right rises because, unlike its left counterpart, like real examples of its governance or its rule were not absolute disgraces. You know, you can actually point to the 1950s and say that was a good time. But the problem is actually getting back to there or getting back to your idealized, hypothesis, right? Like, how do you actually get back to, return to tradition?
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's like in the Victorian era things, and I'm not a huge, I'm not a fanboy of the Victorian era, but I do like it. And one thing that's often said about that is that it was, in a way, it was deeply conservative. It was deeply concerned with maintaining certain notions, certain ideas, certain traditions, social mores. But on the other hand, it was also very forward thinking and progressive, with small p, progressive. So maybe it relies on a compromise. You can maintain certain ideas, but in order to do that, you have to have a certain, I don't know, zest, certain joie de vivre, which I don't think the right has had throughout the entire 20th century. Well, certainly the second half of the 20th century. And certainly the 20 years of this century, I think it's the right has been virtually non-existent, if not completely non-existent, as a social, as an actual social force. So I don't know. I don't think it has to be the case that the right is just this silly reacting blob that gets panicked by anything the left does and eventually comes to some kind of peace with most of what the left has done and then reinforces it. That just seems completely self-defeating and destructive, self-destructive.
Like, how do you become an actual agent and not a sort of onlooker, like looking at a sort of degenerative process of nature? Like, how do you...
you've got to have some balls. I mean, you've got to have, the courage to actually stand for something, which doesn't mean being...
That's right.
You know, I think nothing is ever going to change in this regard unless we're prepared to openly disagree with the left, not on points of pragmatism or realism, but actually on points of principle. No, we fundamentally disagree with you on this. And here's why.
Well, what does the right fundamentally believe in? Or
well, it depends who you're referring to.
When exactly.
We can see what the left fundamentally believe in, which I would say is nothingness and equality, which is nothingness.
I see it more the left as an organism, as something like the Borg, right? From Star Trek. Where everyone is fundamentally equal but the same and all detached from any sort of hierarchical individualism. And I guess that's the point of NRX, to get back to combat the Borg and to get to a point of hierarchical individualism.
So that resistance is no longer futile.
So the yes, that is correct.
Okay.
how do you actually get there, though?
Well, that's a big question. Do you want to go into the? Yeah, let's because we're heading for the end at this point. So I think this has been a good chat, but let's do what we were going to do in the first place, which was talk about the cathedral. Because this first came up that I asked you to appear on Millennial because I wanted you to characterize the concept of the cathedral, because this is surely the most central NRX concept. So have a go at that and then we'll wrap up. What is the cathedral?
Well, first off, we have to say what it is not. It is not a cabal. It is not a conspiracy. It is an emergent phenomenon. So I would define the cathedral as a mystery cult of power and as a universal religion. Now the actual mechanics of this religion is defined as the cathedral. Now the cathedral, it has a very long history that goes back to, I guess the Reformation itself, but it is the ideological, it is an ideological apparatus. It is a consensus making mechanism, in which the current reigning progressive ideology, spits out its propaganda. So in his essay, Gentle Guide to Open-Minded Progressives, Moldbug asks why Harvard, Yale, and I forget what other Ivy League school is. He asks why they all agree with each other. Why does the New York Times agree with the Washington Post, and why does the Washington Post agree with just about every other mainstream media source, aside from I guess weird offshoots like Fox News? Why is there a reigning consensus, and what is this consensus making machine? The answer, this is a decentralized network of individuals who are working with a certain meme in their heads, a certain bug. We all know what progress is and what progressivism represents. It is the effects of globalization. It is the deterritorialization of the old world. It is Cthulhu, but Cthulhu is made up by, Cthulhu is not an actual object. It is this idea in everybody's heads. You all know, like, what a progressive thinks and what their talking points are and what the consensus is. But what is the actual, how do these ideas translate into hard power? And that hard power is the cathedral. So the cathedral, this religion, this idea, it has its roots in its sort of salvationist roots in Calvinism and in Quakerism and a lot of different mainline Protestant sects. Like, if you go back and look at who supported anti-slavery movements back in the 1850s, you know, they have the exact talking points as progressives do now. Like, I was reading a book on privateering in during the American Revolution, and the Rhode Island Protestants had the exact same views of equality of the soul and how and free markets and free people. And anti-slavery, and this religion has been around for a long, long time, and it's synonymous with sort of the Reformation and the birth of modern capital itself. But it's this emergent phenomenon, right? It's consensus reality. It is, it's the moral framework that people kind of what people sort of see as ruling the world, I guess. So some guys are saying that I'm barely coherent. I'm probably just rambling on at this point. But the cathedral is.
Whenever I ask someone to talk about the cathedral, I generally find it's best just to leave them to it rather than intervene, because it's such a complex concept that even someone who's well-versed in it, like you, tends to need to move around it in order before they can characterize it succinctly.
All right, so the cathedral is... it's a universal religion plus its physical apparatuses. So it's education, the media, certain consensus-making NGOs and lobbyist groups. So there is an idea. So that idea is universalism, which is progress itself. And then there is the cathedral, which is its actual physical mechanisms. Which are the actual brick and mortar institutions. So what is progress? Well, we went over this earlier. It's deterritorialization. And the agents of this deterritorialization are agents of the cathedral. It's all kind of meshes together.
So it's the apparatus that maintains what is called progress.
Yes, progress. That is what it is.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. All right, well, let's leave it at that. Don't worry. I know it's a high-pressure question. Maybe I shouldn't have asked you at the end, but I might as well. That's fine. Okay, so Clossington, people can find you on YouTube. Your channel is linked below. Are there any final things you'd like to say before we wrap up?
Let's see. I've been on something of a long hiatus ever since the early summer, but I'm going to be coming out with a series on Nick Land and his more obscure works. I believe that ironing out NRX philosophy is a lot more important than beating the dead horse of mole bug pop history at this point. And I'm fairly active with, meetups and I guess on the ground activism. Whatever you do, do not take the online keyboard warrior approach. Like, get out there and join actual right wing groups on the ground.
That's quite unusual for an NRX person to say that, in my experience. The emphasis was always on online talking things through in a very academic way, whereas you're saying to actually do things in the real world. That was anathema to NRX 5 years ago.
Well, I mean, it's fundamental. Well, NRX... Nick Land is the father of accelerationism. I don't know how many people actually read what accelerationism is, but it has this bad it has this sort of bad dichotomy of its followers. Like, accelerationism is the idea that a capital, it expands, it deterritorializes, it grows. Capital expands at about 3% a year, compound growth. But what happens when that bubble bursts and you're left with nothing? Well, that compound growth is acceleration, and the accelerating deterritorialization of identities. Now, what happens when and if it crashes? Like, we don't know. What does that look like? Nick Land, when he was a little bit more crazy and leftist in the 90s, said it would be the end of capitalism, whatever that means. It's complicated, but accelerationism is the study of this accelerating process of progress, and it has been turned into something like, just relax on your keyboard, because there's nothing you can really do. Capital will just expand no matter what you do. That's one. And two, the seed pill.
Let's go into that.
That's
a different type of accelerationism, which we don't need to go into here. But I know what you're referring to.
So, yeah, I say find a nice middle ground. The cathedral will not reset itself. So actually be a political actor, but don't take the wrong type of accelerationist pill, and don't be a keyboard warrior, because that's my nice middle ground.
All right. Okay, well, this was Clossington, so thank you very much for taking part in Millennial 2020.
No, well, glad to be on.
Okay. I'll be back in about an hour, and it will be a DLive only stream with Apollonia and Germ. So I will see you then. In the meantime, Clossington, thank you, and I'll see you all later.